Listen, there has never been a better time to invest in self-storage, and there's no better team than ours to show you how to do it, because we wrote the book on how to invest in self-storage. Literally, we created the best-selling home study system titled How to Find, Evaluate, Purchase, and Manage Self-Storage Facilities. We have helped thousands of people launch and scale their self-storage business and have become the nation's go-to resource for all things self-storage. That's because we not only talk the talk, we walk the walk, day in and day out since 2005 through now, two recessions and amassing a 2.5 million square feet of self-storage, totaling over 15,000 doors nationwide. There is nobody else that has more experience in self-storage that is teaching people how to invest in self-storage. So if you're ready to launch and scale your self-storage business, then go to selfstorageinvesting.com. Click on the events tab to grab your ticket to the upcoming Self-Storage Academy. So that again is selfstorageinvesting.com. Click on the events tab. Seating is limited. And on behalf of our team, we look forward to seeing you then. Take care. This is the Self-Storage Podcast, where we share the knowledge and skills from the industry's leading investors, developers, and operators to help you launch and grow your self-storage business. Your host, Scott Myers, over the past 16 years, has acquired, developed, converted, and syndicated over 2 million square feet of self-storage nationwide with the help of his incredible team at selfstorageinvesting.com, who has helped thousands of people achieve greatness in self-storage.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Self-Storage Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Myers, and this week's guest is Jeremiah Boucher with Patriot Holdings. Now, Jeremiah specializes in the acquisition and development of self-storage, manufactured housing, and industrial properties, and since 2001, he has aggregated a $280 million portfolio. His vision for Patriot is to grow his portfolio to over $1 billion of assets within 5 to 10 years, and he has also recently released a book titled Finding Your Edge and is a regular contributor to Inside Self-Storage and has appeared on several podcast. So, Jeremiah, I don't know how we haven't had a chance to sit down and catch up, but welcome to the show. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. I'm excited. Excited to be on here.
Well, Jeremiah, I gave everybody a little bit of information on your background, but now if you would, $280 million, my gosh, get us up to speed of how you started, how you got into the business, and what your prospects are for growing Patriot to get up to $1 billion in assets.
Yeah. So 20 years in the industry now, I'm 41. I quit college. I grew up here in Vegas. Got into house flipping, then got into manufactured housing. So I spent a decade really cultivating a manufactured housing business or mobile home parks. Grew that business in a way where I had no money. My parents weren't in real estate. I didn't really have any prospects for a career. So I had a real tough time with that 07, 08 crash. So figured out with the housing market, then I jumped into mobile home parks. What I did is I sourced deals for 10 years for Frank Reynolds, Dave Rolf. They created this MHP fund, and they really taught me the ins and outs of how to buy parks, how to analyze them. Had a lot of crazy stories running around the country, meeting with mom and pop owners and putting deals together and really, really earning my wings in terms of understanding just real estate investment in general, especially in the alternative commercial real estate asset class. So from that point, I found out that I like the business, but there's a lot of challenges around the business. And that business over time, I felt couldn't be scaled in a way that I would grow into the type of company I wanted to build. It's a great, great commodity. It's a great asset class. For me, though, the property management, the asset management is very difficult. And I believe in this stage of the economy and the asset class maturation phase, it is overvalued. I think a lot of the assets out there have a lot of capital improvements needed, a lot of repairs and maintenance, a lot of deferred maintenance. So the infrastructure of these properties are typically 50 years old. A lot of the homes are older and they're going to be taken out. So not to make this about mobile home parks, but I finally decided I really want to move out of that type of asset class. And I bought my first facility in 2015. It was in New Hampshire, where I'm originally from. My parents are from. And that was just a little tertiary type market where it was on the border of Vermont and in New Hampshire. It's across from a Walmart. People, they didn't allow a Walmart in Vermont. So everyone would drive over to New Hampshire. They would drive by this facility. It was small. It was only 15,000 square feet, but it was on 6 acres. And, you know, listening to your podcast in the past, it was those perfect ones where you had all that extra land to expand. It was a good little template on there. It was always fully occupied, really low rates. And the owner lived in the house next door that they subdivided off. So I bought that facility and it really opened my eyes where I thought, wow, my dad thought I was crazy. He was way out in the western part of the state and he thought that it was all rural and hillbillies and nothing's going on out there. And actually, over time, the owner stayed on, helped. I bought her out of it. She seller financed and we did some creative financing around it. She stayed on and managed it for me. And over time, it doubled it in size and then tripled it in size. And we've expanded it 4 times. But that opened my eyes like, wow, these single story, suburban, tertiary type markets in storage can really, really be a viable business model. And I loved having the minimal touches in relation to a lot of other assets, minimal property management in terms of mobile home parks. So that over time got me more and more interested. And then in 2019, I had a good exit event where I sold a lot of my manufactured housing communities. I took $10 million and I put it all back into storage. And I said, I'm gonna really grow this thing. And that's when I built my storage management company, which is, we only manage our own assets. It's called All Purpose Storage. And because we're in a lot of these small markets, we really wanted to be hands-on with the assets. We wanted to understand these little markets. We wanted to understand the construction process, the local demand, what our customers wanted, how to market in these markets and get traction with some of the customers. And it just evolved. So I just been building around. I mean, this is my central focus. You know, I follow what you do. I really like what Nick Huber's doing, AJ Osborne, all these guys. You don't have to be a big REIT. You don't have to be in a core market. You can make a lot of money just doing value add improvements or ground up construction in some of these secondary and tertiary markets.
Mm-hmm. The focus has always been our business model is to get into the secondary market and the tertiary right up to the point where it becomes rural, because then it is difficult with a smaller facility and management. And depending upon the route that you take and the path that your business grows into, that management piece, that is always the difficult part. Do you use, especially if you go across state lines, now I need to take a property management company on because I can't reach over there. And if I lose an employee or two, it's more difficult to backfill. And it's always that give and take. And Storage Nation here is me say it once, they've heard me say it 100 times, nobody cares 1% as much about your facility as you do. No matter who the management company is and how well they do what they do, they still don't care like an owner does. And so it's essential, either you start that way or eventually you'll come back to the place where you have to manage. But for most of us, I don't know about you, Jeremiah, but managing and running a management company and everything that goes along with it, a trip to the dentist is much more enjoyable than the management side of the business. I get it. I know how to do it and everything that goes into running a facility well and driving the performance. I just don't want to do it and be in that all the time. So it sounds like you've done it from the beginning and had a lot of success to get to the place where you are right now. Tell us a little bit more about the journey of running an in-house management company alongside, because it's almost like two different businesses.
100%. That 100%. Yeah, that's a good point, Scott. And I'm with you. I am not the operations guy. I do not enjoy operations. I love doing deals. I love construction. I love the creativity around raising money, structuring deals creatively. That is the most challenging part of the business for me as well. But having that control is imperative. And then also your point, just before I address that one, it is really, really good to differentiate between the tertiary secondary markets versus the really rural markets. And I took a beating on a facility in Winnemucca, Nevada, where I talked about it in my book a little bit, but I could not raise rates. I was at $55 on a 10 by 10 for 8 years or 7 years. That was the other facility I bought in 2015. An older gentleman, nice guy, had like 20 acres, continued to build, tracky buildings. He didn't make money. He just kept building and building and building, filling, never raising his price. The town only had maybe 10,000 people, 15,000. So there was 3 other big operators in town, if you want to call them big. And we just could not raise our rents. So I just have to impress upon everybody that if you're in a low rent market and there's no barriers to entry and you have no growing population, it's not always a home run. I don't think people share that enough. I'm sure you have a lot of stories around that. But yeah, that's a good differentiation. And then for the management side. So for me, I think this is a team sport. Business is a team sport. Real estate is. So I had to find a key operating partner. And I only scaled the business with that operating partner. They're a minority partner in the company, but they have equity. And they really do control the processes, the hiring, the firing, and the on-site and remote operating processes. Now, the private equity company I have in Vegas, that operating company is in New Hampshire. Our assets are primarily in the Northeast and some in the Midwest. So we have a call center, a maintenance department, and then we have the hub and spoke model where we typically have one core manager that can manage 200,000 square feet in a region. So parts of Maine, parts of Massachusetts, parts of New York. And then they'll have maybe a maintenance man and another part-timer underneath them. And they all answer to that core office in Keene, New Hampshire, which is all our operations. Now, we do some of our accounting. We share the processes here in Vegas. We source all our deals, get the financing, raise money. That's all the private equity portion. So I'm sure a lot of your listeners understand that, but I just wanted to differentiate. This is storage management and the storage operations. That's all-purpose storage. That's been a process. We started out, I don't know how granular we want to get with it, but the remote model, since COVID occurred and you've been talking about this, it's really started to change the game. And we all know this in the industry now, where remote management is more the norm, especially in secondary and tertiary markets. It's been a game changer. So for us, we're learning how to really operate a company with low operating expenses on each asset. The burden on each asset is very minimal. And the efficiencies continue to grow over time. The way we're doing that is really empowering not only the manager, the customer service rep for that region, is helping them really to field calls, having them field calls, but they answer to our central office. And we really try to spread that person out, so they're never at one facility more than 1 or 2 hours a week. That is our goal there, to keep our operating costs low. For us, we started with Easy Self Storage. It's a great software for beginning users, super easy with browser-based software. But after about 10 facilities, 20 facilities, we really outgrew it. We're almost up at 70 facilities now. And we had to pivot. And that was a big decision for us, right? Your software determines a lot of the processes that you build in your management company. And for us, we really dug into thinking, okay, do we do something on our own? Nope, that is a lot more heavy lifting than we want to deal with. We looked at a lot of different softwares, and then with Storable buying everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much, right? So we went with Storage, and then the power there is, and we're still really honing it, and we use their call center software platform. And that really is helpful because it's a lot more visually, aesthetically appealing for our call center. They can find customers easier. They can track who's calling in. But what we really liked is that we had the control of seeing all our reports, consolidated reporting across 70 assets, all on one dashboard, somewhat of API integration. So we really have a snapshot of how the individual asset's doing, how the portfolio is doing, and then practicing revenue management, right? Where we really win, where I think Nick Huber does a great job and you do a great job sharing, taking this REIT model, taking revenue management and bringing it into small suburban tertiary markets and being the leader in that market. We don't want to be the low price leader. We want to be the highest price out there, right? As long as there's demand. So we want to continue to raise those rates, test the market, provide a great product, right? Pave it, paint it, light it, fence it, get the whole thing looking great, then expand on it when the demand's there, but then push the hell out of that rate and find out where the tipping point is, where you actually really start to drop down in the below 90% occupancy. Mm-hmm. And that's been the game changer for us. I mean, it's been pretty easy for us to come into a market, be top three in Google right away when you have less than 30 or 50,000 people in your MSA. Mm-hmm. That's been helpful. For me, my thesis around where the markets I want to be in, I really like a minimum $12 rents. Like, I need $12 annual average rents, because we're heavily emphasized on our value add with construction. You know, we have a construction department. I brought on another key partner. I've known him since I was a little kid, did construction 20 years after high school. We came on board together, and that was a game changer for us. I've heard in some of your other podcasts, guys that can really make the construction process efficient can create a basis that is pretty low in these types of assets, even with costs that have gone up so much. Mm-hmm. But because so much demand has been coming after them, you know, institutionally and through just private wealthy people, they are driving up the value of these assets. So we love building for 60, 65, 70 bucks a foot. In our markets, it's worth 125 to 150 a foot stabilized. That is our core model, but that is all done in-house. I mean, we self-GC, we find good vendors. We tend to stay in a region before I start scaling out to do any heavy lifts like a conversion, or if I'm doing any major ground up projects, I don't feel comfortable doing them down in Florida or Texas or where I don't have a presence. The presence I've been working in the last 10 years has been the Northeast. That for us, we build in markets where we know there's already a huge demand. We already have good revenue increases in rents. We already have a good feel of what our customers want, big units, small units, a mix of them, contractor units, climate control units. And then we start plugging in these, rather than, I saw guys 5 years ago, they would build a multi-story facility in Florida, sell it at C of O with nobody, even lease it up, and made $5 to $8 million. And I thought to myself, like, am I doing something wrong? Why didn't I go do that? But it could have went the other way too, right? When you're dealing with 100,000 square foot lease up, typically that could take a long, long time. So I played it safe, singles and doubles, mm-hmm. just doing 30 to 60,000 square foot facilities, good rents, relatively decent occupancy, but low economic occupancy, just dial in on the management, and that really improved the asset values. And I think we all kind of lucked out in the industry in the last 18 months. I didn't know revenue would go, like rates would go up nationally like they did. Mm-hmm. It was outstanding how much they went up. So it made us look like pretty sharp, but I think that, I don't know, I'd love to get your opinion on this. And the next 18 to 24 months, so many construction starts are happening. So much new supply is coming on board. I'm a little nervous. I don't think the increase in rates can continue, but I don't know, maybe they can.
Yeah, it'd be interesting, Jeremiah, that I was looking forward to getting your take on this 20 years on in the business as well. You know, we've been through a couple of recessions, and the last time around in 08, construction lending stopped abruptly, and then demand, as it always does for storage during a recession, skyrockets. We get the hockey stick effect. Businesses and individuals are downsizing because we're in a recession, and the demand goes up, yet the pipeline was beginning to dry up. Right now, we're seeing, as you mentioned, a whole lot of development starts. Just talked with one of the large SBA lenders that is still underwriting. They haven't put their pencils down on development, which I was a little surprised to see. But I do believe that we can't withstand these aggressive hikes in interest rates. Eventually, some of these deals aren't going to pencil out. They're going to fall off of people's desks, and they're just going to be put to bed, or they're just going to go away for a while. And I think we will see a slowing of development. But again, those folks that were around last time, like myself, we built a war chest of capital and lending partners and equity partners because we knew what was going to happen. We saw what happened last time. There was a shortage. And so we are pro-development, we're pro-value add, but mostly by way of expansion, as you mentioned. So it's one thing to turn around operations, but this right now in the next 3 to 4 years is going to be the biggest land grab that I've seen in my history in real estate and in storage. So we're absolutely going like gangbusters to build, buy with the ability to develop as well, but not all those deals make sense. So that's my take. My crystal ball several times been in the shop, and I don't always refer to it. It's not always accurate, and so time will tell, but that's my take.
I was in the industry in 08 to 012, or 08 to 12. But was there opportunity, because you had that war chest of capital, to go in and get assets at a good basis, even though the recession did help the asset class?
Yeah, there was. And what I learned back then is that I didn't have enough. I didn't have enough lending partners, and I didn't have enough private equity. And so we doubled down and got really good at that because there's a lot of projects that were abandoned. Some of the projects right now, they may not pencil out under the existing structure that a developer has, but somebody coming in fresh can look at it a little different way, probably get a better deal, and it'll pencil out with his cost of capital and his capital stack. And that may make more sense at that point. So I wish I had more cash back then or low cost capital, because there's a lot of good deals that fell by the wayside because the banks just said no, and the developer was at the end of their rope in terms of cash, or the way they had structured it wasn't going to work anyways, no matter what the rate was. But if you can come in and kind of take them apart piece by piece and then work with the capital stack and some parameters and capital that is a little more patient and a little less costly, there's going to be a lot of deals that I feel, again, will be abandoned, that'll go away, and some folks will be selling these projects off partway through or before they even got off the ground. They'll be selling their engineering plans, they'll be selling the permits off, just the project, a shovel-ready project for basically just the work that they've done up to that point. So those are the projects that we're looking to get involved in. Again, nobody wants to take advantage of anybody else or the situation that's going on in the economy, but we know that there will be some opportunities for us to be able to step into some projects. And so that's what we've been preparing for since, 10, 11, and 12.
Are debt markets different than they were back then, do you think, nowadays?
They all stopped. There weren't a whole lot of development projects that were getting off the ground unless you were a REIT or very well established. And that took about 5 to 6 months before that really came back. And then we saw the development boom come afterwards. But it took years before we were able to even catch up with the demand. And you could argue right now that we still aren't in that place where we have enough storage to keep up with the demand from the last recession. It just depends on the area in the market and who you talk to and how you look at it. But I see that happening again, except this time right now, where rates where they are, lenders have seen self-storage. We're in a different place right now. We're seeing that self-storage is very, very popular. When people are exiting Wall Street, they're looking for yield and they're looking for hard assets. And so that's real estate. And self-storage has done extremely well during every recession, but especially weathered the storm since the last, it's outperformed all the other asset classes. So now self-storage is in a different place. We are the Cinderella of the real estate industry, and this asset class truly is the belle of the ball. And so everybody knows now to run to self-storage during a recession because of the dynamics and what happens in our industry, in our sector of real estate. rate and that we do benefit from a recession. So I think there's a whole lot of more people running to it, and banks, they want self-storage on their balance sheet because it has the lowest loan default rate, lowest loan loss rate, because it does well during a recession. So that, I believe, is the difference. The fundamentals have been there all along. It's just now that the banks are wising up, and so they're all in on self-storage this time around.
Yeah. Okay. To your point, I have not seen a slowdown either on the development side. With typically, we always are using community banks, regional banks, credit unions, right? They're the only ones that stomach or have the appetite for development, ground up development, or and even expansion, large expansions. And I believe in what you're sharing is that, knowing my core markets and where there's good demand, where there's good traffic counts and good demographics, good low supply, I believe, to your listeners, it's a whole different ball game developing versus going and acquiring an existing asset. And a lot of guys that, especially if you're in secondary or tertiary markets, you'll find contractors, local real estate developers or investors, they'll get a project off the ground. You're right. If they're in their mid-60s and with the economic sentiment out there that there might, there's a lot of fear out there, potentially a larger recession on the horizon, who knows? These guys are moving forward. I believe the same thing. And there's not the same capital pool chasing permits on land that there is for existing assets. So I'm being very patient with the projects, the construction projects that I'm now acquiring. And I'm really just, you know, we have almost 20 projects in the middle of just growing, like building right now and in development. So now I just really, really picky in terms of the next projects that I want to build in the next 1 to 3 years.
Yeah, 100%. We're having more candid conversation with our lenders as well. And for those that are listening, we love you guys. Love having you as partners. But we're having candid conversations with all our lenders right now to say, lenders just don't like to say no. Even if they know ahead of time, this is something that either the bank has said, hey, we're holding off on deals or projects right now, then they may come back to us and make the terms look so bad to say, hey, well, we're going to lower the loan to cost on your development or loan to value on your acquisition. And we need to see this amount of reserves, and they'll make it very, very difficult for the deal to pencil out anymore, so that you just say, well, I think I'm going to have to take a pass. That's too bad. And at least the lender didn't have to say no. And so literally just got off a call right before you and I got on, Jeremiah, where when the lender said, well, do you have any questions for us? And I said, the only question I have is that I would request that you be 100% transparent and candid with us. And if there's anything about this project that you even think is going to cause a hiccup or loan committee to say no to it, then I want to know immediately, or just tell me now. Because the last thing I want to do is get further down the road and lose a week or two, because in today's interest rate environment and how fast it's changing, I can't afford a week. I may be facing another 75 basis points bump in interest rate, and that does not bode well. So that's the difference in the way that we're approaching this right now, is we just want the lenders to be upfront, and hopefully we won't get caught out in another interest rate hike or two within the time frame in which we're really getting ready to break ground, because then some of these deals may not pencil out. Or even the lenders at that point will say, well, now the cost of capital has gone up and your month to cash flow went from 32 to 36, or it went from 19 to 24. And for us, our loan committee has just said, no, we have to be cash flowing by this month. And so the deal's still solid and strong, but the lender may pull out only because the math just doesn't work anymore. So that's what we're just keeping an eye on at this point as we head into the future.
Yeah, we are too. I think the, like you mentioned, the having a good relationship with your bank, you know, we love our lenders. Actually, there it's a little more of a pain to deal with upfront building that relationship with a smaller regional bank or a credit union. But for me, they do actually have more of an identity, more character, more of a face than some of the institutions, because I named the institution, but they hammered us last minute where we traded 150 basis points on a three-pack refi where we were in the mid-fours and we were at 615 with 10-year IO, which dramatically changed the dynamics of that deal. And that reduced our proceeds by $500,000 too. And to the listeners, you know, that was frustrating because I own those assets 3-4 years, did all the construction, built it up, stabilized it, did my job, right? And then it performed. And then rates just jumped through the roof. And now this lender, through this last 90 to 120 days, completely changed the economics of the deal, where we don't cash flow now $3,000 to $4,000 less than what we expected. And $500,000 of proceeds didn't go in our pocket. That was a kick to the, you know what? So that's why I really value my relationships with the regional banks, because at least we stayed in the high fours, mid fives, but luckily they haven't came back and retraded us, at least with the ones that I had all relationships with. And they were up front, like you said, just give me an answer up front. Give me 70 or 65% loan to cost up front, rather than the 75 to 80 that we're projecting. So it's a precarious place right now, though, because on a dime, they could totally just change the debt market and we don't know where they're going to go. And also loan maturity date. So that's the other thing, is just making sure that I have enough runway where if capital markets dry up, that I can make sure every project we have, you know, 80-90% are value add, and we have to get it. Once they're stabilized, we got to put non-recourse debt on them, or I want to. I'm signing on all this debt. So that's something in the back of my mind. But what I'm doing, I'm liking to do, is making sure that these regional lenders amortize the loan fully. Mm-hmm. And even if I can't get a fixed rate for 10 years, after 5 years, at least if I'm within the covenants and I get in at a low cost basis with the way I buy it or the way that I build, I can still cover the debt ratio, the debt coverage, if it's 7-9% interest, worst case scenario, and they can't call the loan due and take the asset. Mm-hmm. I'm on the defense. I'm in protection mode a bit now, but I still, you know, I want to be aggressive and I want to go buy. But it took a long time to get here, and now I want to protect the downside.
Well, you have to, and that's what experience shows. There's things that are beyond our control, and having this wind in our sails for the past 10 years, we knew it was going to end at some point, and so being prepared for that is wise. And then the things that we can control, as you mentioned, you've done a fantastic job of doing, Jeremiah. You started in-house property management. You had a partner, somebody that you knew, you trusted, that you partnered along with that. Development is in-house as well. The investment side is you, and I'm sure a couple of lieutenants, but then let's talk about, we also have a financial services company within our company. We operate that way. So let's talk about the private equity side and raising capital. Tell me how that operates. Who's the head of that? And a little bit about your org structure and how that came to be so that you could get to that place where not only got to where you are now, but then how you get up to that $1 billion.
Yeah, I think storage is a great asset class that's somewhat standardized, ubiquitous. So in the sense of, I did 10 years of private syndications, you know, friends and family, meeting people at conferences, just basic retail investors and minimum investment of $20,000 to $50,000 and just bootstrapping it for 10 years, right? And getting creative terms with sellers or sellers reinvesting back in the assets. And then I hit about 3-4 years ago, I hit a threshold where I was running out of bandwidth with my team, and it was so much work, and it still is so much work dealing with 50 individual entity asset updates where I want to perform. I want to show the investors their quarterly financials. I want to get the K-1s in on time. I want to make sure that the updates on our occupancy and our construction projects get out there. But when I'm doing that 50 times and uploading 50 portals and 50 videos, it's just killing me. So I had to go to the fund model. That was the natural growth. And for me, I had predictable deal flow, cultivated a database for 15 years. I have a ton of people that I know that are older that want to eventually sell. We have an acquisition staff. So there's 5 guys here. We're calling these people, underwriting the deals, all the good companies do. That was predictable for me. So once I knew I could continually bring in assets and I could deploy the capital, I got to a point where I had to find that structure, that vehicle to aggregate the money to say, hey guys, my investors out there, I have to go to a fund model to be able to perform for all the investors here. Here's the structure. I didn't know anything about funds, and it was really difficult. There wasn't a lot out there 4 years ago when I was first learning, and or at least I perceived that I didn't find anything where, how does the preferred return work? What is the preferred shareholders' benefits? And just getting used to that process. And that was a game changer, and it's been great. I have noticed that a lot of people out there are adopting this, and a lot of new funds are being created. And it's a structure that allowing me to perform better for my investors. So the first fund was $15 million, and we had a preferred return, a 10% preferred return, and a return of capital hurdle, and then we split it 50-50. And then as I grow and get bigger, we're starting to turn into, I'm dealing with bigger and bigger investor groups. I don't receive money from institutions or family offices at this point, and I wanted to keep control of my company and kind of be the decision maker and have autonomy. But that's limited me on how much capital I could raise. I've hit a threshold where there's only so many people that have $50,000 to $500,000. And once they put that in my fund and an asset, they're like, yeah, I got storage covered, and I'm not going to put in $2 or $3 million into storage. So I'm having to grow in this sense of changing some of the terms of my fund, where there's more aggressive hurdles in favor of the LPs, where there's a higher IRR hurdle of 18%, where it's a 30-70, and that 70 is in favor of the investors, the LPs. And then after we hit that 18, then I get to share in the 50-50. So I'm trying to make it more attractive to these investors, but it took me a while to come to that point. And I'm not saying everyone has to do that. I'm not sure how you guys do it with your funds, but I noticed that I get scrutinized by institutional investors because they look at the 2-in-20 model of typical private equity, which I'm sure we could do a whole podcast on this, where in my eyes, these guys are just pushing paper around and allocating capital, buying companies. There's not a lot of hands-on management. There's not a lot of off-market deals. and they're going to get their 2% of their capital under management and their 20% of the upside. For me, I feel like sometimes it's a little unfair for us smaller storage owners where we're personally guaranteeing the debt, we're hands-on managing the assets, we're finding off-market deals, we're doing tons of work on the research to find the right markets to be in. So in terms of getting chopped or analyzed like institutional investment, where if you're raising $500 million or $1 billion, that 2% and 20% of the upside is quite significant for a 20-person private equity team. We have 20 to 25 people in the private equity plus another 30 people in our storage operations. We have 55 to 65 people in, as employees. Those fees are a lot less. We're raising $15, $25, $50 million. That's a lot of money for us. So it's been a challenge confronting the institutional investment community saying, guys, you know, my returns speak for themselves, but it's a different model than typical institutional private equity. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that argument. And if you've had that discussion with some of the larger institutional groups and how you've helped your people around that discussion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have, and to your point as well, we can point to our returns. It's one thing, and there's a whole lot of folks that have raised a lot of money and bought a lot of stuff in the past 10 years. So a whole lot of funds started in people syndicating and getting into self-storage and other commercial asset classes. But only time will tell. And even those that acquired or developed and sold in this environment that we've had with extremely high valuations, abnormally high valuations, they've had a big wind in their sail and at their back, everybody looks like a hero. Well, now we're on the cusp of finding out who truly is a hero and who was benefiting from the market. And so those that are exiting now and for the next couple of years, did they hit their marks? What kind of projections did they put out? Did they account for an inflationary cycle and a recession? Are they falling short of their projections? Are they still exceeding them or just meeting them? So the approach that we take is, first of all, you have a known quantity when investing with us. And that is, here's our track record. We've been through two recessions and here's our returns on those. Here's our projections and here's our returns. And I would just pose the question to several of those folks to say, well, certainly if you're looking at other folks, this is a question you need to ask them and or look at, and what is their track record? And has it been through a recession or has it just been in this environment? Because it's been pretty easy. So that's how we've been able to combat that. So to your point, Jeremiah, it's real easy for these folks to ask for everything, but if it were easy, everybody would be doing it. And us active investors that are looking for to bring passive folks along with us, yeah, we're taking on the credit risk, we're taking on the development risk, we're taking on the lease up risk, and there is some reward that needs to be had for that. And so their demands, I think that folks got a little bit spoiled in this market here. And so now they've lost their money when they've invested in, after they covered their base in storage and they invested other places, they're going to come back to us and they're going to find that the returns are just going to be a little bit less because rates are a little bit higher and we have to cover on that as well. So we're comfortable with the folks. That's why it's a relationship business. The folks that are coming and just asking for returns after not building a relationship with us, we tell our folks right out of the gate, hey, just be a troll and hang out and watch us. Attend the webinars, look at our projections and look at our reports and what we're doing before you feel comfortable with us before jumping in. Great that you know, like, and trust us and you want to get involved right away, and certainly won't turn you away, but not every deal is going to appeal to you, and we want to build a long-term relationship, so you need to feel comfortable with us, because once they are and they've done one deal with you or they watch you long enough, then they're going to back up the truck, because we all know that everybody's got 50 grand or 100 grand, but larger institutions, they may test us with that, but then we want them to say, okay, now we're all in, and now we're going to invest $5 million and stroke the $10 million check, and we want to partner with you. That's what we're looking for.
Yeah, I agree. At the stage I'm at now, I think right at this point, it's interesting. We just have to get over the finish line on our development projects and then really look at the way we've been underwriting deals the last year has been dramatically different than the last two, three, 4 years. Because for me, when I got into storage in 2015, I really didn't count on a lot of rent increases. And that was the opposite, was in manufactured housing the last decade. And I think it's closer to the tail end. The rent increases were dramatic. There was a reduced rental rate. It was prevalent around the whole country. A lot of the mom and pops never raised their rents on manufactured housing. So there was that backstop where you could immediately raise rents and cover your basis, even if you didn't really buy it right. I think it's pretty tapped now, and especially when you're dealing with affordable housing and fair housing and rent control and all those things, that could be the governor and buffer on that. On the storage side, over the last 12 to 18 months, I mean, our rental increases, it bailed everybody out. Everybody looked like, wow, it penciled out even when I overpaid by 10 or 20%. I saw a lot of guys still look like geniuses. you've been in this longer than me. We look at underwriting moving forward. Can we count on, you know, inflation is real and our costs are increasing and everything's increasing in cost. What are your thoughts on future revenue increases? There's a lot around that in terms of specific market economics, but what are your thoughts of how to potentially project where our revenues are going to go in the future?
It's interesting, Jeremiah. We're really starting over almost in how we underwrite facilities. I mean, for years, to your point, we'd underwrite a facility and even the consultants, a 3% in existing facility, 3% increase in rents year over year, 2.5% in expenses. And that's how everything was modeled out. That's just how we all learned how to do it and kind of followed on that, made the banks happy. In reality, it was a little bit different than that, but not too much. And then we passed a year and a half, we see 13% month over month in our 10 by 10s and RVs going up, you know, 22% month over month. And so looking at our annual figures, we know it's been an anomaly because the demand has been so high. But it's forced us to take a step back and look. And, you know, to your point, you can overpay for a facility and then still look like a genius and a hero because the market made up for that. Again, that wind in our sails, as I mentioned before. But now we realize that many of these facilities, when we step into them, if they haven't, one of the reasons why we're buying them, if that owner hasn't raised rates in 3 or 4 years, we're going to see a pretty significant jump in the first 6 months or a year of maybe 15 to 20%. We'll underwrite conservatively, but it's not going to be a 3%. And so that's what our projections are based upon. And then just like we have dynamic pricing when we set our rental rates, we're underwriting using dynamic, I've recently termed in our organization, at least, as a dynamic underwriting. And I did a podcast on that as well. And so it's no longer a straight line 3% and 2.5% income and expenses anymore. We're digging back in, we're sharpening our pencils, looking at the market, looking at the facility. Are we adding expansion? Well, that means, okay, we're going to take a hit. You know, we're going to go into the winter months with a lower revenue because we're going to reduce our rates to keep people. And then it's going to ramp back up again. And so we're really taking a harder look at that. And then our exit strategy revolves around our exit strategy. Is that a refinance? Is that where do we think interest rates are going? And what's a cap rate going to be at that time? And how does that affect the overall exit? Just being very, very mindful of what that looks like at the end when we're able to get our capital back. So we're taking a much more disciplined approach to how we underwrite based upon the market that we're heading into and how storage has changed.
I want to ask you a question in this is, what do you say to investors like me, Sunbelt states, Florida, Texas, the hottest states in the whole market? Should someone try to break into those? Is the population growth continues? Is that sustainable? Is storage, is there opportunity, better opportunity elsewhere? I know it's a broad question, but I keep thinking about it. And investors are always like, they want to be in these markets. For me, I have a lot better competency in other markets. But what are your thoughts on guys outside of that market getting into those markets?
If you want to lob that softball in there for both of us, Jeremiah, I'll just tell everybody listening to stay out of Florida and Texas because you and I are already there. So how's that? There's one answer. Very, very attractive markets. And what we're looking at is Texas is still in many, many areas the wild, wild west, which means that there's not a whole lot of policing and governance over permitting and zoning. And so anybody can put up something next door to you. And in many cases, many other communities, they'll take a look at this and say, well, first of all, we don't want a lot of storage or there's been a lot of pushback. But also they recognize that, hey, if we just allow everybody to have a permit and tell them to build, they're going to beat each other up. They may not even be doing their own homework. And for their own good, we're not going to allow all these permits to go through because some of these folks are going to go out of business and they're not going to be on our tax roll anymore. And then we're going to have a vacant building that we may end up having to take care of 3 years from now when it goes through foreclosure. So that's part of the risk that we've seen in Texas, Florida. We haven't seen that as much. They're very more rigid and a little more strict in terms of a development. And so we feel a little more comfortable from that standpoint. In terms of demand, I see that we are going to continue to have demand for storage facilities that we can sell later to international and foreign investors. They're gobbling up everything in the Sunbelt states, period, especially if it's along the coastline. So I think there's always going to be a demand there. And as the aging population continues to age, there's going to be, there continues to be a migration for the unforeseeable future down to Florida and Texas. And now Texas, in the political climate that we're in right now, I think they're closer to seceding from the union than anybody expects is the place to be. And so it is a very attractive place to live is the same. So I don't want to say that, again, be bullish on those two states for just say carte blanche, go for it. And they're never going to go down in value. At some point, there is going to be a saturation point. But we know that in storage, your market's about 3 to 3.5 miles, roughly. And as long as you do your homework and you check to see what other permits are in place and know what the city is doing, you should be in good shape if you've dotted all your I's and crossed all your T's. You just need to be smart about where you buy and do your homework before you end up pulling the trigger on a development or on an existing facility for that matter. And I'm sure there's many more touch points that we can hit on, but that's my 30,000 foot take.
Yeah. So I'm not in those markets yet. I've looked and analyzed those markets. I've been successful, one, because I just didn't want to compete with all the other investors, which I love those markets. I believe in everything you said. I went with a contrarian approach in the sense of, because I knew a lot of other markets throughout the country in the Midwest and Northeast and Mid-Atlantic through mobile home park investing, because those Sunbelt states were already saturated with institutional buyers of mobile home parks for the last 30 years, right? I really didn't know those markets that well. So I kind of stayed in the sandbox that I was comfortable with. What I did notice for your listeners is, like, even if you're in Ohio and Wisconsin, Minnesota, and certain up and coming suburban markets, we've noticed, or tertiary markets, we actually can draw from about 10 miles out on some of these markets where we are in a commercial hub where we, you know, we have the Tractor Supply, the Dollar General, the Walmart down that street. I'm able to get land under $500,000 or under $600,000. There's still barriers to entry. I don't, it's not like Texas. I mean, you still have to sell the community on the project and it has to be zoned properly. But then we're getting good lease up because we're only seeing 3-4 square feet per person in that market in that 20,000-30,000 people, 10-mile radius. You're tapping in from a lot of other small towns that feed into this town. And I'm not saying, you know, that they compete with Florida in terms of the Western Gulf Coast where everybody's moving and it's growing. But from a cash flow standpoint, I'm very satisfied. You know, I'm hitting our 10-11% cash on cash. And if I have a long-term hold of 10 years, I feel good about a lot of these projects where my portfolio, I want to aggregate it where it's, I'm not cutting pieces out of it and selling off core gems to REITs or institutions. I want to keep that model, kind of that machine growing together. It's been a nice run. So I think for some of the new guys, especially with SBA out there and what's available, it's been a good play to get in with a lot of less competition, a little bit lighter cost basis, lighter down payment. But for me, I'm thinking now at this stage, I don't think I'm going to go down there just because I don't know the markets and it's quite competitive and I don't want to buy an asset for $150 to $200 a foot on a single story older facility. But I'm sure there's always time to jump into it. It's just, I wanted your feedback on that and thinking, do you try to stay around your markets that you already are in, or do you bounce around to a lot of different markets and wherever the deal makes sense?
We've done a little bit of both. So if we can get economies of scale in a market very quickly, then we'll jump into a new market. But as soon as we find a sizable project, then we're doubling down on our marketing to the rest of the existing facilities to see if there is anybody else that is interested in selling, because we feel that, yes, it's important to have a very strong person behind the counter at our store, at our facility. But what is more important to us is having an area manager, regional district manager, you know, depending upon what you want to call that person that is overseeing that person that is at the stores in a market and that can see the marketing that is working across 3, 4, 5, 6 facilities in an MSA. That's what brings value. And so to chase the one off, if it's small, it's going to suffer. And you're paying for the marketing for one versus in a market, if you got 6 facilities that are all sharing in that marketing budget, sharing in the district manager that is training those folks and keeping an eye on their KPIs, that's when it makes a big difference. So the markets that we're currently in, those are the ones that we're looking to grow, unless, again, we get pulled into another market and it makes sense to do so. And to your point, also a little surprised, one of our projects in Minnesota, we're always sticking within the 5-mile radius of marketing, and we struggled moving the needle at one of our facilities, a Class A new ground up construction project. And then all of a sudden, we had our management company test the market a little bit, and they went out to that 10-mile mark, towns a little further away that had facilities in it and started marketing, and lo and behold, our occupancy just shot up within 90 days. And I wouldn't have expected that because it goes against everything that we've ever done or learned. And the only time that had ever worked in the past is maybe in the oil patches out in South Dakota when we were looking at projects out there, but didn't think it would work in most MSAs, but it does. It does make sense in the right areas. Well, Jeremiah, what I'd like to do is, I think we need to have a round two because we've really just kind of scratched the surface on scaling, but I wanted to be mindful of your time as well, and then also give you a little bit of time to talk about your book. First of all, the reasons for that, I mean, I flipped through and I think I understand, but tell us the genesis of that, and then also how do people find it?
It's called Finding Your Edge, How to Win at the Game of Commercial Real Estate. It was a pre-COVID project, and then COVID pretty much drove me to staying home and writing for a year and a half. And it's just something that I felt passionate about. But at the end of the day, the essential message is, like the title says, I'm passionate about real estate investing. I believe in personal responsibility, taking control of your own financial future. And I believe real estate is the way to do that. Mm-hmm. So with the competitive market that we are in, because information is so prevalent and there's so much capital out there chasing assets, that you've got to define what your edge is. Like, what is that competitive advantage that you have? Mm-hmm. It's not only money, or it's not only knowledge about real estate. It's about, what is your demeanor? What is your personal skills? What are you passionate about? So it's, you know, finding, and I broke it down into six key aspects of what I felt were the most important things in building a real estate private equity company or being a great real estate investor, and broke those down. For me personally, it was just a cathartic process to put it out there and say, you know, what really differentiated me from everyone else? And then how did I play to my strengths? And then how can someone else go through this process to figure out what do they really want to achieve in real estate? And then how do they play to their strengths? I really love that topic. And it's something I can continue to just riff off of and go get into. And that's why I was so excited about the book. And it's more of like a workbook, the process to, you read it, there's different phases of your career, different phases of your life. And then during those phases, you're a little more aggressive, you're more on the offense. Other times you're more on the defense, or you're more on the altruistic side. They're more on individually building something versus collaboratively leading and building something. And I've had to go through all these transitions in my life. And at the end of the day, I get to become a better person. I think business and investing made me a better person, a better leader. I'm a big sports guy, and it was the arena that I got to play in. It's the game we all have to play. So let's get a framework around it and then understand your niche in the economic game and then get after it. Play it to the max. You know, have fun with it. Do something with your abilities and play to those strengths if you're passionate about real estate.
Yeah, years ago, I visited Dan Sullivan and joined up for the strategic coach and spent a year in time with him and going through that. And he's written several books. And really at the core of Dan's teachings is, what is your unique ability and finding it? And then spending 80% of your time in your business doing it. Because if there's other stuff you're not good at or you don't like it, then your business is going to struggle. Certainly those departments are going to struggle. And so hire the people that is their passion, that is their unique ability, that is their edge. And then put those people in those seats on the bus so that you can spend 80% of your time doing what you like and what you were born to do within your own business. So 100% appreciate the work on that and helping people to be able to find it within the real estate game as well, because that is the key for so many people in their business that's keeping them or holding them back, as the leader isn't doing what he's born to do and what he should be doing in his business. So how do they find you and how do they find your book, Jeremiah?
It's on Amazon. Just Finding Your Edge, Jeremiah Boucher. My website's patriotholdings.com. All Purpose Storage is my storage brand. If people want to see it, it's at storeallpurpose.com. And then I have a personal website they can, with some different tools on there from the book that they can tap into. I'd love to do this again. There's a lot more we want to talk about. I would like to talk about just so many comments that I have to the points in the book. So hopefully we could do it again. Scott, I enjoyed it.
Oh yeah. Stay tuned for part two, folks. And Jeremiah, you and I will have to do this again. So appreciate your time today. It was good to get to know you a little better and learn a little bit more about the empire you built this far in your journey up to 1 billion. So with that, thanks everyone for joining us, and stay tuned for part two with Jeremiah. Thanks everyone.
Hey gang, wait. Three things before you leave. First, don't forget to subscribe to the Self Storage Podcast and turn on your notifications so you never miss another episode. And while you're there, please leave us a 5-star review if you like the show. Second, be sure to share your favorite episodes and more via Instagram, and don't forget to tag us. And lastly, head to the links in the show description and hit the following subscribe button on Twitter and Facebook to get a front row seat as we grow and scale our business and bring you along with us. Take care.